When you listen to some of the top items in the news these days, heck, a lot of days, you might think the world could use a little more empathy. Today's guest will probably agree. British philosopher Roman Krznarek wrote the book on empathy, at least a new book on the subject, called simply Empathy: Why It Matters and How to Get It. Roman Krznarek is a big believer in the power of empathy. He's a founding faculty member of the School of Life in London, and he advises organizations like Oxfam and the United Nations on using empathy to create social change. He's been in the Exchange twice before, most recently 2 years ago, to talk about his book, How Should We Live?, about using the wisdom of philosophers throughout history. Roman Krznarek, thank you so much for joining us again on the Exchange.
Thanks for having me on the program, Jeffrey.
Your focus on empathy is not new, it appears. How did your interest in empathy develop?
Well, I've actually been interested in it for about 10 years. I used to be a college professor teaching politics, and I used to think, well, the way you change a society is through, you know, elections and party politics and laws and new institutions and things like that. But I gradually realized that empathy, that ability to step into somebody else's shoes and look at the world through their eyes, is an incredibly powerful form of change. It's a way of challenging assumptions and prejudices that we might have because you see somebody as being a little bit like you. Ultimately, it's about humanizing people. And I think, as you know, you're sort of saying that when you look at the news today, you certainly feel there could be a little bit more empathy. Look at the Paris attacks, look at the migrant crisis, the migrants coming to the Middle East, to Europe, and other things like that. I think empathy, that makes empathy a really hot topic.
But it is important at any period in history, I think, is what you're saying.
Oh, absolutely, and it always has been. It's always, we often hear in history about the moments of empathy collapsing on a large scale, whether it's the Nazis and the Holocaust and the Second World War or the Rwandan genocide. We don't hear so much, though, about the importance of empathy for building societies. And I think that's really important, too, that if you want a more tolerant society, we need to be teaching empathy to our children.
Roman, how often is empathy derided, as you put it in the book, as a fuzzy feel-good emotion?
Oh, it's really interesting. I think particularly in the United States, it did start getting derided a few years ago when Obama, President Obama, actually in the lead up to the 2008 presidential election, started talking about the country's empathy deficit. And he said it was just as important as the federal deficit. And then that brought up a lot of critique, people saying, well, empathy is just touchy-feely stuff. It doesn't really change anything. We should use laws and reason and so on. But actually, there's been a big shift in the last few years at the same time because there's so much research, particularly in neuroscience, showing that empathy is hardwired into our brains. We've each got a 10-section empathy circuit. And if you maybe get part of your brain damaged in a car accident, for example, you might lose your ability to recognize fear or other emotions on somebody else's face. So with growing recognition that empathy is part of our makeup, we're not just homo self-centricus, self-centered beings, but we're also homo empathicus, empathic beings, I think that has challenged that idea that empathy is a bit of a fuzzy, feel-good, nice-to-have extra.
If there is an empathy deficit in an individual, I mean, is it a case of empathy begets empathy? If you're raised around empathy, you're going to end up having it yourself?
Absolutely. If you're a parent and you want to create an empathic child, well, what you do is you don't tell them you ought to be stepping into other people's shoes and be morally good and empathic. You demonstrate it yourself in your own relationships, and children learn by modeling it. And so I think what you get is, can get a virtuous dynamic in a family where parents or caregivers are modeling empathy and the children get it too. The problem is, of course, that that doesn't happen all the time. And that's why I believe that we ought to be teaching empathy to elementary school kids, particularly just as much as we're teaching them geography and math. And luckily, there are really powerful programs that do this. Probably the most famous started in Canada some years ago called Roots of Empathy. And over 750,000 children around the world have done it. And the way it works is fantastic. A classroom of elementary school kids actually adopts a baby, a real-life baby, not joking here, a real-life baby for the year. And the baby visits every few weeks with a parent and an instructor from the program. And the kids sit around the baby, and they start talking about the baby. Why is she crying? Why is she laughing? What's she thinking or feeling? They're trying to step into the baby's shoes, of course. And they use that as a jumping-off point for then talking about, well, what is it like to be a kid bullied in the playground? What's it like to be someone in a wheelchair? And that program is incredibly powerful, Roots of Empathy, at increasing cooperation in the schoolyard, reducing bullying and conflict, and even increasing general academic attainment. So I think every child should have the right to be doing it.
That's a pretty amazing program, unlike the ones where you drag around the electronic doll that cries at various times and you have to comfort it.
I think we can do a lot better than that. We learn best through experience. Leonardo da Vinci said, experience is my mistress, and that goes for kids as well as Renaissance geniuses. If you learn from a baby. I mean, even my son, for example, I've got a seven-year-old son, and he's not a terribly empathic person by nature, but he loves little babies. Kids love babies and respond positively to them, and it's a great thing to see and a great way to learn.
Roman, you're careful to distinguish empathy from sympathy. Explain the difference.
Yeah, I think a lot of people get these two things confused. Imagine you're walking past a homeless guy in the street. Now, one response you might have to him is you feel sorry for him, you feel pity, and you toss him a coin. That's what psychologists normally call sympathy. You have an emotional response, but you haven't really tried to see things from his perspective. It's just a sort of general compassion or pity. Empathy is taking things a step further. That's where you really try and imagine, well, what is it like to be him with his experiences? What's it like to be walked past by people all day without someone looking you in the eye? What's it like to sleep out rough on a cold winter's night like you may well be having this evening? And so there's that big difference between empathy and sympathy, and it makes all of the difference, because that's how we really know what somebody needs. It's how we can really tell, well, what are their feelings? What are their emotions? How can we respond in the most appropriate manner?
Much more discussion about empathy with Roman Krznarek. He's our guest. His book is Empathy, Why It Matters and How to Get It. We'll come back and talk more with Roman and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. We'll return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest once again is the British philosopher Roman Krznarek. His latest book is called Empathy, Why It Matters and How to Get It. We'll explore things like whether you can obtain empathy if you don't in fact have much of it already. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with your questions or comments on the topic of empathy. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Roman, there's a case study in here. Who's Patricia Moore and what did she do 35 years ago?
Yeah, Patricia Moore is the opening story of my book, and she's someone who's still around now and is an incredibly inspiring person. She's one of the United States' most famous designers, product designers, industrial designers. And she's extraordinary because back in the 1970s, she was working at a design firm called Raymond Loewy in New York. They're the people who designed the curvy Coca-Cola bottle. And she was in a meeting with some of the senior partners who were all men, and they were talking about something kind of boring, which was the design of refrigerators. And she said to these male senior partners, she said, could we design the fridge door so it would be easy for an older person with arthritis to open? And one of the senior partners turned to her and said, Patricia, we just don't design for those people. Now, that made her really angry. And what she decided to do was to conduct an experiment, an empathy immersion experiment, where she got a Hollywood makeup artist to turn it into an 85-year-old woman with arthritis so she could find out what it was like. She put makeup on her so she looked kind of old and wrinkled. She put on fogged-up glasses so she couldn't see properly, bound up her hands and arms so she couldn't pick up a tin opener properly or open a fridge door. And then she spent 3 years finding out what it was like to... She went and visited over 100 cities, finding out what it was like to go in and out of up and down subway stairs, open department store doors, try to open refrigerator doors, things like that. And it was extraordinary. What happened at the end was she came up with amazing inventions. If you open your kitchen drawer, you'll probably find one of those thick-handed potato peelers or tin openers. That's her invention. It's called the Oxo Good Grip, and it was designed after her experiment of having tried to use a tin opener with her hands bound up. And so in many ways, she's influenced our lives, and today she's still working designing rehab centers for Iraq and Afghan war veterans, U.S. war veterans coming back, trying to work out how they use a cash machine, an ATM, how do they get in and out of a car or even get in and out of bed when they've had brain injuries or physical injuries. So it's an example of stepping into someone else's shoes having a big impact on people's lives.
And it was literal in her sense. She really did walk in someone else's shoes. I mean, someone older and not as physically fit as she was.
Absolutely. And when you see photos, she did it when she was 26 years old, and you would never know. She looks 85. And it was dangerous, too. She got beaten up in Harlem one day, and it, you know, devastated her. She wasn't able to have children after that, as she's told me and also written publicly. So that kind of empathy immersion was quite extreme. But you can think, well, how can we do it in our own lives? I mean, there are lots of experiments. There's a charity thing that runs in England, and I'm sure the same thing happens in the U.S., called Live Below the Line, where you try and live for 5 days on a couple of dollars a day, which is what, you know, a billion people around the world try to live on. You get try and have a bit of a taste of their life. And I think that's a good way of trying to immerse yourself in someone else's world. Or think of Nelson Mandela when he was in prison. He was brought up as a Methodist, but he went to the services of people from every different religion. He had a big interfaith empathy experience, and I think that kind of thing helps breed an important kind of tolerance.
There are occasions in this country when people will eat on what are allotted for so-called food stamps over the course of a day or a week or something, and try to figure out what it's like to try to budget that tightly for your food. I don't know if it goes a whole lot larger than that. You get into the 6 habits of highly empathic people, switch on your empathic brain, make the imaginative leap, seek experiential adventures, practice the craft of conversation, travel in your armchair, and habit 6, inspire a revolution. Let's come back to 1, switch on your empathic brain. I mean, we all have the capacity physically. I mean, nobody's actually born without empathy, are they?
Almost everybody is born with empathy, and it's a deep evolutionary trait. You can look at primates, chimpanzees, like the bonobo chimp, and you see empathy in operation there, and we've also had it for a long time as well, because, of course, in evolutionary terms, we've required empathy to cooperate with each other, to share food, to protect ourselves from predators, and so on. So it's deep inside who we are. Sometimes you might have heard about what are called mirror neurons, and these are neurons which fire up not just when I feel pain, but when I see somebody else experiencing pain. And the neuroscientists say, well, this is partly how we feel other people's emotions. These mirror neurons are literally mirroring what other people are going through. But there's some controversy about these mirror neurons in our brains, because the research done on them was done on a type of monkey, which is an incredibly aggressive, nasty kind of monkey. And so the jury's really still out on the power of mirror neurons. But certainly, this empathy is wired into us. But the thing is, we can learn to get better at it. We can learn empathy like riding a bike or, you know, driving a car. And I think any couple who are arguing with each other all the time ought to be doing practicing a bit of empathic conversation as well, which is another one of the habits.
Roman Krznarek's book is called Empathy, Why It Matters and How to Get It. Roman's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. The biologic roots of empathy, though, I mean, all humans for sure. Is it all mammals?
Not all mammals seem to have empathy. What we notice is that there are creatures who are quite like us, for example, chimpanzees, but also dolphins and elephants seem to show empathic traits. But the problem is, of course, we don't know exactly how other animals are always thinking or feeling. Can we really step into the shoes of a 8-millimeter-long baby fish? We feel that we can maybe understand our dog when we look them in the eye, but really, how much do you get how they're feeling? What we do know, of course, is that if you see an animal cowering because it's about to be hit by a stick, you can see that they fear pain, and we certainly empathically connect with that. Though really how far it extends into the animal world is a slightly open question. You know, I don't know if I can pick up the perspective of a bee or a hedgehog, but I certainly know that if I'm a small animal and there are roads built everywhere and I can't cross the road without getting squashed, that's not going to be very good for my life. So we can at least try to take the animal's perspective as much as we can.
What was the 3-mountain task that Jean Piaget gave to kids that you mentioned in the book?
Yeah, that task, which was a 1940 psychology experiment by the Swiss psychologist Jean Piaget, was really interesting. He was trying to show how that the capacity to step into someone else's shoes begins early on, by the age of 3 or 4. What he did is he got children to look at a model, a 3-dimensional model of a mountain, and he put a doll on one side of the mountain, and he got children of different ages to draw what the doll was looking at. And what he found was that little kids, about the age of 2 or 3, when they tried to draw or even describe what the doll could see, they actually described their own perspective of the mountain, not what the doll could see. But once the kids were about 4 or 5, they could actually describe or draw what the doll was seeing. In other words, they could look through the doll's eyes. And now modern research shows that this capacity develops by the age of 2 or 3. And I've seen it in my own children. I have twins, a boy and a girl. And when they're about 1 and a half, before the empathy kicked in, you get a situation like this. My son would be crying, and his sister used to try and comfort him with her favorite toy dog, which was kind and sympathetic, but absolutely no use to him. Fast forward a year when they're about 2 and a half, and that cognitive capacity of empathy had developed. When my son was crying, his sister would reach over and give him his favorite toy cat. And that, of course, made all the difference. And we can imagine that power developing not only in children, but it's something that we need, you know, amongst adults as well. We all need to see the perspective of people from different cultures, different backgrounds, and different age groups.
It was a good demonstration your daughter did.
Oh, yeah, she's a fantastic model for empathy. And if only we retained it all. But the problem, of course, is that a lot of empathy gets beaten out of us as we grow up. Religious ideologies, political ideologies start taking away that natural empathy that develops in us, and we develop prejudices, of course. And so the big challenge is, how do we confront those assumptions that we all have? You know, I consider myself an empathic person, but I remember a few years ago walking down past a homeless guy around where at the corner where from where I live, and I never thought I'd have anything in common with him, and I just assumed he was not someone that I could connect with. And one day I stopped to talk to him, and it turned out I live in the university town of Oxford, in England, and it turned out he had a philosophy degree from Oxford University. And we developed a great friendship based on our interest in philosophy and pepperoni pizza. And I was, you know, had as many assumptions as anybody else. And I think none of us can go around thinking that we're empathy superheroes. We all need to try and confront our demons.
British philosopher Roman Krznaric is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His latest book is Empathy, Why It Matters and How to Get It. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Your questions, your comments, your stories about empathy, more than welcome at the Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you were just talking about the things that drain empathy away from us. And you were talking about political ideologies and religion and things like that. So it sounds like empathy can certainly be pulled away. Can it be taught, though? I mean, if we don't particularly have much of it, can we learn empathy?
I really do believe that we can. I mean, like I mentioned earlier, there are school-based programs like Roots of Empathy. But I think even in everyday life, I mean, we've all been in situations where you're arguing with your husband, wife, or partner and thought to yourself, oh, God, I wish they could just see things from my point of view. I wish they could understand what I'm feeling. Well, what are you asking for? Empathy, of course. And what you really want is empathic listening. And this is something that we can all learn and practice. Now, what empathic listening is about is, if you're in a tense situation with someone or arguing with them, what you need to do is two things. You need to listen out for the other person's feelings, and secondly, listen out for the other person's needs. And ideally, give them a space to articulate their feelings and their needs. And it's amazing how it can reduce the tension. Ideally, even going further, you can try and reflect back what the other person just said to you so they understand that you understand them. And the great master of this particular method was a guy called Marshall Rosenberg, who invented something called nonviolent communication. And he pointed out that in labor disputes between employers and employees, if both sides literally repeat what the other side said before they start speaking themselves, you reach conflict resolution 50% faster. Now, I think that is quite amazing, and it shows the power, literally, of listening, because in the end, we all just want to be understood, right?
Indeed. Empathy, though, you point in the first of the six habits, switch on your empathic brain, that there are really two versions of it, cognitive and affective. Cognitive, I think, is self-explanatory. What is affective empathy?
So the way to think about this is, if you, for example, see there's a child in front of you with anguish on their face, if you too feel anguish, that is, you're mirroring or sharing emotions, that's what's called affective empathy with an A. Okay? It's a mirrored response. The cognitive empathy is where you try and imagine, what is it like to be them, putting yourself in their shoes, stepping inside their skin. That's what, for example, the book To Kill a Mockingbird is all about. And the central line of that is, never really understand another person until you step inside of his skin and walk around him for a while. The great Irish dramatist George Bernard Shaw once said, "Do not do unto others as you would have them do unto you. They might have different tastes." You know, cognitive empathy is about discovering those different tastes. But of course, we need both of them. You know, if you go to your local doctor, you don't want your doctor to be all empathically overrun and overwrought by your anxiety and stress, having too much of that affective empathy. You also want them to step out of that emotional thing and just try and understand what you need and where you're coming from and to be able to help you. But you don't want them to be totally disattached from you. They're always in a dance between the affective empathy and the cognitive empathy. So we need them both, but the cognitive one is the one we can really train up.
Habit two in the six habits of highly empathic people is make the imaginative leap. And you point out that there are barriers. You already talked about religion and politics being major ones. Prejudice certainly gets in the way of empathy. Authority you bring up here as well. I'm curious to know what you mean by that.
Well, authority goes back to this idea. If you go back to Nazi Germany, for example, well, a lot of people who were involved, for example, working in the concentration camps said, well, I was just following orders, right? And it was authority. It was the pressure of authority which broke down their empathy. This was the idea. And there was a series of famous psychological tests done in the 1960s where in the United States, where the subjects at Yale University were told by a guy in a white coat to basically administer electric shocks to somebody sitting in the other room. And even when they could hear the other person crying out, they still administered those shocks. And it seemed to be evidence that we would, you know, under the pressure of authority, we would overcome any natural empathy we had, and it would be broken down. Now, I don't totally buy that story, because I think when you're with a group of other people who are revealing empathy or showing it, you tend not to be so subject to authority as much as those experiments showed. But certainly being under somebody's thumb can reduce that empathy.
Rowan Krznarek's book is Empathy, Why It Matters and How to Get It. The which makes me wonder then if empathy and either antipathy or violence are sort of the yin and yang. Are they two sides of the same coin?
Yeah, I think in general they are, because highly empathic people tend not to be violent people. They tend to try and understand what other people are going through. But there are complexities here. For example, let's take a figure like Nelson Mandela. Now, this is quite a complicated case because he was a highly empathic person who believed in, you know, racial equality and social justice. But he reached a point, particularly in the 1950s, before he was put in prison, where he believed that the only solution to fighting apartheid and desegregation in South Africa was to turn to violence. And he basically led something of a guerrilla war against the South African government. Now, there was a highly empathic person, I think, believing there were no other options. The legal options have failed, the peaceful process had failed, and then turned to violence. It's a kind of a rare case, but it's one worth contemplating, that you might be empathic, but the instruments you use are not necessarily empathic when you want to achieve change.
And one of the major steps you point out in applying empathy is to humanize the other. And you give Oscar Schindler of the Schindler's List fame as an example. Do we tend to default to not humanizing the other? Do we tend to just block ourselves off from that sort of experience?
I think there's a whole load of factors in society which keep us blocked off from others. I mean, as we've lived increasingly in urban societies where people don't know their neighbors, they get afraid of people from different racial backgrounds and religions and so on, we start putting up all these barriers to people. So I think we need to, even though naturally, I think, you know, again, you look at children, they will talk to kids of whatever race, color, or creed. But as we get older, we need to do something about it. And I think we need to practice humanizing our imagination. And one of the ways I think of doing that is simply just once a week, or even just once a month, spend the day thinking about everybody involved in your daily life, the people on which you depend but you don't normally see. When you're walking down the sidewalk, think about who was it that built the sidewalk. When you're drinking a cup of coffee, think about who picked the coffee beans. We need to make that conscious effort, I think, to see the real people behind our everyday life. And that starts opening our minds. It starts opening a kind of compassionate response to the world around us, rather than just going about rushing off to the next meeting like everybody's busy doing.
But, you know, in some sense, it's a little easier to do when you're not particularly stressed. But how much more difficult is it for us to humanize the other when we are scared or threatened?
Well, I think we all have that fight or flight response, right? When you're backed into the corner, or you're in, there've been lots of psychology studies showing that if you're in a rush, you're going to walk past straight somebody who's in distress. I remember an instant, a kind of shameful instant, when I was a 13-year-old, and I haven't thought about this for years, actually, when I was growing up in Australia, and I walked past an old lady who'd fallen over at the train station because I was busy going on my way to tennis practice. We can all do it, but those moments I think we can keep in our memories as ones that can be clarion calls to perhaps act differently in the future.
Yeah, things, situations in which we wish we had used empathy. Empathy is the title of Roman Krznarek's book. We'll come back and talk more with him about it, and you can join us as well. Back to the Jefferson Exchange with Roman Krznarek and you in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the British philosopher Roman Krznarek. His latest book is called Empathy, Why It Matters and How to Get It. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about empathy and the ability to feel what other people are feeling as a way of making the world a better and perhaps more comfortable place for all of us. 800-838-3760 if you'd like to join us by phone. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. Roman, you write that you want to go beyond the golden rule into the platinum rule. What is that?
Yeah, I think that's a great distinction, and one I actually teach my kids. So we all know the golden rule, which is do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Now, the problem with that, which is a very nice principle, but it assumes that your interests coincide with somebody else's, that they see the world the same way as you, that they care about the same things that you do. The platinum rule is about a bit different. That's do unto others as they would have you do unto them. That's about really trying to imagine their situation. And it's something that I discovered, or really had an epiphany about this, when I was back in my, near where I grew up in Australia, actually, and I visited a local art gallery, which had, when I walked in, an art exhibition made by indigenous Aboriginal people, the sort of Australian native people. And it was a war memorial. It was called a war memorial. And they were kind of like didgeridoos. And I thought to myself, well, what war are they talking about? And then when I read more about it, what the art exhibition was about, it was about how from the Aboriginal perspective, the British colonization of Australia in the 18th century, the Aboriginal people see it as a war, as an invasion. Now, I'd never tried to see it from their point of view in that way. I was so deeply brought up with the idea that the British coming to Australia was a good thing. But actually, there was a war going on. And I think it's that seeing how they would want to be treated from their point of view is really fundamental to treating people from different cultures and different backgrounds.
We have a call here from Jeannie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Roman Krznarek, the author of Empathy.
Hi, good morning. I was watching a study where prisoners, I believe they were pretty much violent, were given a dog from the shelter to care for, and how they changed. And my thought was, they couldn't show that kind of tenderness and caring in the population because that would make them vulnerable or mistake for weakness. But yet with the dog, it was just amazing how they changed. If you would comment on that, please.
All right. Caring for another creature. Thanks for that, Jeannie. Appreciate it.
Yeah, that's a really good example, Jeannie. I think what the research shows is that, again, prisoners or kids who are not having problems growing up who might be violent and so on, give them a dog to look after, or give them a horse also is one where there's been a lot of research on that, and it absolutely transforms them. And it's interesting to think about what's going on there, why it happens. And I think you're right to mention this thing about vulnerability. I mean, I gave a talk in a prison just last week about empathy. And what the prisoners were telling me, and these were people who were murderers and rapists and armed robbers and so on, they said that, well, you can't really make yourself vulnerable in a prison. You can't. It's very hard to show empathy because, of course, it's an ultra-tough environment where you have to be wearing a mask and so on. And the culture is one of looking after yourself, even though, as individuals, the people might want to be doing something different. So I think empathy has a really great role. And it's interesting how animals can almost be a bridge. And you find this in some of the good empathy teaching programs in schools, use animals as a bridge to, well, if you look after an animal, you look after a human as well. But equally, it works the other way around, because what the research shows is that children, for example, who have empathy teaching programs about trying to step in the shoes of other people, equally, that increases their caring about issues like animal rights and general ecological awareness. So it runs in both directions. But I think it's a really important possibility where we can, you know, show that empathy can start to be learned and social cooperation as well.
Debbie in Talent sent in an email. She asks, do researchers know if empathy takes place in one particular part of the brain? If so, could it be physically stimulated?
That's a really great question. Unfortunately, we are not yet at a stage where you could put yourself forward for an empathy neurosurgery and become an empathy superhero by a certain part of your brain being tweaked. The current research shows that empathy really operates in probably 10 main centers of the brain, and so that it's more like a network rather than a specific spot. But as I mentioned earlier, if a particular spot gets damaged, like in a car accident, you might lose particular empathic abilities, like feeling other people's feelings, that affective empathy. There might come a stage where we can start manipulating the empathic brain, but we are not quite there yet. But when we are, I think the world will be a different place, and we might become a little bit more like Mr. Spock from Star Trek, who used to do his famous mind meld, where he could feel the feelings of any creature from anywhere around the world. Some of my favorite Star Trek episodes are really actually all about the art of empathy.
In fact, don't you mention the one with the Horta, the mining creature?
Yes. Yeah, that's right. There's a great Star Trek episode where they can't work out why all these people are being killed on this planet, and it turns out there's a strange rock-like creature whose babies are being destroyed by the miners, by the humanoid miners. But only when Spock understands that babies are being killed, and that's what's worrying these strange, dangerous creatures, can the problem be solved. They stop killing the baby eggs, the little eggs, and everybody's happy again. So Star Trek was ahead of the game in the power of empathy.
And Mr. Spock, indeed, was the one who mind-melted with the creature and felt the pain and finally got to understand everything. Your own experience, Roman, trying to understand Guatemalan oligarchs. Walk us through what happened there.
Yeah, back in the 1990s, when I used to work as a scholar, academic, I went and did research in Guatemala, and then I worked with refugees. But what happened was that I ended up doing research on studying Guatemala's ruling families, the people who control the country, who own the big sugar plantations and coffee estates and banks and factories and so on. And that was very challenging for me because when I talked to them, Guatemala had a civil war, of course, for 30 years, and many of the people I spoke to had done some pretty nasty stuff. They'd funded death squads that had killed journalists, trade unionists, and peasant leaders. And it's one of these really awkward things where you're trying to step into somebody else's shoes and understand their view of the world, but you don't necessarily agree with what they think or what they say. And that's very important to recognize. The act of empathy doesn't mean you have to agree with somebody. The key thing is to try and see their perspective. And I learned something important there about the need for us to try and step into the shoes of our people who have different beliefs from us, even who are our enemies. You know, Robert McNamara, famous U.S. Secretary of State, said that the number one key to good foreign policy making was to empathize with your enemies. He said you need to see their point of view because that's how you become a smart strategist. That's how you develop good policy. And I think there's a kind of truth to that.
Well, it's interesting to think in terms of having to humanize the other, and you can often make assumptions about any category or class of people, in this case, Guatemalan oligarchs or the enemy that you're fighting on the battlefield, but then you realize that they're not monolithic. It's not all people think and feel the same way, and suddenly, whoops, you've humanized, you've removed one level of prejudice there.
Yeah, absolutely, and there's a real power to that, and it can be in a good way. I mean, some listeners might remember the great 1930 Academy Award-winning film All Quiet on the Western Front, which was about a German soldier and fighting in World War One. And what he goes through at the key point in the film is that he kills a French soldier, but then as the soldier's dying in front of him, he opens the soldier's coat and sees his identity card and realizes that he's a real person with a family and with a child, and he feels great remorse because he's killed somebody who is just like him. And I think ultimately that's the power of empathy to overcome those divides. And that's why I very much admire organizations, for example, in Israel and Palestine, one called the Parent Circle, where they bring together Palestinians and Israelis who've both had family members killed in the conflict, and they do great projects like the Hello Peace phone line, where any Israeli could phone a free phone telephone number and they put through to a Palestinian stranger to talk to them about anything they like for up to half an hour. Palestinians could call stranger, could call Israelis on the same phone line. And in its first 5 years of operation, over 1 million calls were made on that Hello Peace phone line. And that's about building empathy from between enemies in many ways, from the grassroots up. And you can think about trying to apply those lessons between, for example, creating new conversations between investment bankers on Wall Street and people living on food stamps, or climate change skeptics and climate change activists. I think there are a lot of empathy conversations ready and waiting to happen.
All right, here's a voice we haven't heard in a while. Kara in Eugene, welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange with Roman Krznarek, the author of Empathy.
Hi. Yeah, thank you. I was very interested when you just said that children are naturally empathetic, and that was really nice to hear. And I've noticed in discussions around racism in our country, it's often said around white privilege, for example, that people are kind of naturally have racist tendencies in our country. People say it's normal to be racist, and they don't often say that children are naturally empathetic. And so I've just wondered if he knows what I'm talking about. Does he have an opinion about, because it seems to me that when in our country, when we say that everyone is racist, that it is offending people that might actually be naturally empathetic. Anyway.
All right. Thanks for that, Karen. Appreciate it. Roman, thoughts?
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I mean, the way I think about it is that children are not naturally racist, and I don't know of any evidence that points towards that. What happens, of course, is that we very quickly find ourselves in tribes, whether it's people in your local community or from your local church or political affiliation, or it's class differences or gender differences. And so over time, these distinctions start developing, where there's us and there's an us versus them mentality. Certainly the evidence that I've looked at is that it's very important to stress that children do naturally develop empathic tendencies. Of course, we also develop in parallel self-interested tendencies. We want to look after ourselves as much as being empathic. But I think that the racial thing is not something that naturally develops in children. And that's why I think it's so important to stress that this is something that, you know, empathy is something that does come naturally to children. We've got to do everything that we can to try and nurture it and let it flower.
There's in Habit 3, Seek Experiential Adventures, you let us know about some people who did do just that, like the man who wrote Black Like Me. But you also write about somebody who examined the split between the haves and the have-nots, and that was, we got to know him as Che, but he was still Ernesto Guevara when he went on his trip. What did he look for, and what did he find?
Yeah, Che Guevara is the controversial figure in the history of empathy, I'd say, because, as many people, of course, will know, that when he was in Cuba in the revolution, he was a pretty nasty fella. I mean, he was presiding over the assassination of and the murder of political opponents. But when he was a young man, he grew up in Argentina, in Buenos Aires, and he went on a famous motorbike journey, his famous motorcycle diaries that he wrote. And that was really an empathic opening for him, because he grew up in quite a privileged upper-middle-class background. But when he traveled around South America, he saw poverty with his own eyes. And famously, when he was in the Amazon, he worked in a leprosy hospital. And that made him change when he was about 21 years old. He decided he wanted to become someone who spread what he called social medicine, quite a toxic kind of phrase probably in the U.S., but the idea that everyone should have access to free health. Now, the direction he later went on was one of taking up arms, a little bit like Nelson Mandela. But the underlying motivation, particularly when he was younger, was around empathy. So I think he's a really fascinating figure, if controversial figure, to look at, well, what motivates us to embark on change and take our lives in new directions.
Roman, I understand that you're actually working on an empathy museum in England. What's that about?
Yeah, the Empathy Museum launched in England last September and is now traveling around the world. It's on its way to Australia. And you might be wondering, well, what on earth is an empathy museum? Well, what it is, our first exhibit, was a gigantic shoebox on the banks of the River Thames in London. And what would happen is you'd walk inside, and a shoe shop assistant would measure your foot, and they would then fit you with a pair of shoes belonging to someone from a totally different walk of life, maybe a guy who'd been in prison for 14 years, a bearded drag queen, or someone who was working on the sewers or who'd gone through a tragic accident. And you would literally walk in a mile in their shoes while listening to an audio narrative of them talking about their own life. So it takes that old idea that we know of never judge another person until you stepped in their shoes, walked a mile in their shoes, and turned it into real life. And it's on its way to Australia. It's going to Beirut and Sao Paulo, and I hope to bring it to Oregon as well.
A final question before we run out of time. Your concern about screens and having our faces in them all the time and what it might do to our empathy.
Yeah, I think there's this big problem of digital empathy because we're pretty much emotionally illiterate online. We all like somebody's Facebook post, but or we might see that, you know, hear bad news that one of their parents is ill, but we don't pick up the phone and speak to them. We rely on just, you know, a quick like or a quick message. Equally, there's a lot of online abuse. 74% of people in the U.S. have experienced online harassment, and that's because of online empathy, online anonymity, and we need to draw on our empathy to challenge that digital divide.
All right, lots of good stuff in the book. It's called Empathy, Why It Matters and How to Get It. Roman Krznarek wrote it and joined us again on the Jefferson Exchange. Roman, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me on, Jeffrey.
All right, take care.